My name is Glenn Jordan, and I'm here. I'm very grateful to be here all the way from Ireland. Not the least of reasons for being delighted is because the sun is shining again. It's great. And I work for an organization, community called Coromila Community in Northern Ireland, the oldest peace and reconciliation community and organization in Ireland. Actually, we have an incredible number of parallels between our place and this place. We're not quite on the same scale as this, but lots of the same traditions for people and porridge for breakfast, always, which is always great. But also that act of hospitality on changeover day, you know, you pay it forward by changing over the beds for people to come on, and it's lovely to kind of slip in a very different culture, in a very different place, and find many of the same traditions that sustain community. If there's a seat nearby, an empty seat nearby, you could wave your hand so we can... just make your way in. And good to be here.
There's one there.
I'm interested, this week we're looking at stories and Sunday school stories now that we're all grown up. And what is the enduring value of some of these stories that we received as children? And we received an understanding of these stories as children, but then life gets much more complicated as we grow older. Is there any enduring worth? And how might we find it? Where would we, how would we look for it, and how might we find it? And so this week, looking at a series of different stories, already thinking that I might change up one or two of them before the end of the week. But I'm trying to find, as I described it yesterday, new doors into these stories to find new rooms in which we can move and maybe find a little bit more space and air so that our sacred text continues to live and grow with us as we're growing. Because the text itself, inside the text, when we read it carefully, we find that it is constantly growing and reinterpreting itself and deconstructing its old things. But I also said that on the way I would tell some, to help you get to know me a little bit. Yes, this is Toby. This is our first family dog when our children were small. And Santa named Toby, to save arguments amongst the kids, but also to save us from the kids giving the dog a name, which I would be embarrassed to stand in public and shout. So we named Toby, and he came to us as a pup. We actually, my wife and I, named him after Toby Ziegler. Any West Wing fans in the room?
Oh, yeah.
Toby Ziegler was our favorite character. And every family, every community, every congregation or parish, every country has its founding stories, its founding myths that it returns to again and again and carries with it along its way. Toby appears in quite a number of the founding stories of our family. One was on this beach, actually, one day it was a Sunday in November. And our kids were, Philippa will be 24 next month, she was probably 8 or 9. And CJ, who's 21, was probably 6, 7. And it was November. November in Ireland is pretty much like July in Ireland. It was cold and it was wet. And we were well wrapped up for a beach walk. And Toby was just a small thing. He was probably about a year old. And we were walking along the beach. And we'd kind of given up the idea of throwing sticks or tennis balls into the water, because Toby would walk out up to his kind of ankles and then decide. So I would hopefully, every time we go, I would, in some degree of hope, carry a stick or a ball. Maybe he might, but never. Anyway, on the way back from this particular walk, we met a man coming the other way with this super athletic dog, you know, like a black collie. And this guy had a chopper for the ball, and he fired the ball miles out to sea, yeah. And his dog bounded out and over the waves and swam, got the ball, brought it back, dropped it at his owner's feet, and just thought, do it again. And I thought, I felt so emasculated. He was so poor. Literally, I couldn't do that. Anyway, this guy and his dog posed off, you know, kind of. And I thought, forgive the language. It was actually worse at the time, but I said, I am going to get this damn dog and teach him how to swim. So I threw the ball a little bit in, but he didn't go anywhere near it, and he just came out, stood by my side, so I scooped him up in my arms and walked out into the sea until I was fully clothed, until I was down this deep in the water, and I threw him in. And he disappeared under the water, came up in a panic, and then swam to shore, and then ran around and ran around, scooped him up again, and walked back out into the sea and threw him in. Same thing happened. He walked back. The kids were beside themselves with delight at this. And so the third time, he's running around and around on the sand, and I scoop him up in my arms again and start walking out into the sea a third time. This time, the kids came with me. So the three of us, plus the dog in my arms, walked out into the November sea, and threw the dog, and while my wife just stood, what have I made? This is my husband and my children, what's going on? But from that day, Toby learned to love the water, and you can see him, this is him as a lot older, and you can, well, I can just see the delight in his eyes at the prospect of throw that ball again, and he would swim for miles. Took a bit to get him there, and it cost a little bit to get him there. Not the least was the fact that the chairs, the seats in our car on the way home were drenched for days and days afterwards, because you don't dry anything very easily in November in Ireland. That's one of our founding stories. That's the kind of story that you tell at family get-togethers, and it's repeated again and again, and the details change ever so slightly, you know, and you've all got them, haven't you? And it's everybody's got them. Every nation has them, as I said. Sometimes those stories that we tell are stories that open us up to the world, but sometimes the stories close us in and close around us, and they're not so helpful to us. As we get ready to think about what I anticipate is going to be a complicated story for us today, I want us to think about the ideas of founding stories and what founding stories nurture us in our family life, in our community life, our congregational life, our national life, and which stories maybe need to be reconstructed or deconstructed or left behind. We've got a problem, really, in Christianity. And actually, it's something I think that's true of Christianity, of Islam, and of Judaism. And that is, we have enshrined in our sacred text stories of conflict and war over our enemies. And we have built these into our sacred text. That's a problem. That can be a problem for us. And because we have enshrined in our text suspicion of the other, and also, this is difficult, but also some permissions to treat the other person badly, sometimes even violently, and it's in our sacred text. And what do we do with that? So we're going, as I said, to look at a difficult story. The challenge for us is when we make God in our own image, it gives us permission to deny the image of God in people we consider the other. Permits all manner of bad behavior towards people who are the other. One of the reasons I've never been a pastor, I've never been involved in church leadership of any form whatsoever. I am a regular, I attend my own congregation every week. It can be difficult enough, I've no doubt, to lead churches. But I work with the Bible all the time. We don't have a better resource than our sacred text. And the reason I think we don't have a better resource is because within this text itself, as I said a moment ago, the text itself is constantly deconstructing these ideas. So when we read a story like the one we're going to read in a moment, and then we encounter within the story itself something like the book of Isaiah, which in chapter 56 talks about a new thing that's happening, which is about opening up a space here for, as Isaiah calls them, foreigners. Creating space for people who are normally outside us. We've got to do this. Jesus comes along and says, you know, if someone strikes your face, strikes the side of your face, turn the other cheek as well. He pulls people into the circle that normally are the practice of faith educates us to keep away, to keep pushed out. The text is constantly reinterpreting itself for new eras. The Hebrew Bible says once, love your neighbor as yourself. And it says 36 times, love the stranger. I think we've got to do the maths. Sorry, you say math. We've got to do the math on these things. So I want to give you some words to carry with you through this session from Barbara Brown Taylor. The hardest spiritual work in the world is to love the neighbor as the self. To encounter another human being not as someone you can use, change, fix, help, enroll, convince, or control, but simply as someone who can spring you from the prison of yourself, if you will allow it. All you have to do is recognize another you out there, your other self in the world, for whom you may care as instinctively as you care for yourself. To become that person, even for a moment, is to understand what it means to die to yourself. This can be as frightening as it is liberating, and it may be the only real spiritual discipline there is. Okay. Story of Joshua and the walls of Jericho. How many of you are familiar with the story? Hands up if you're familiar with the story. Good, there'll be some people who won't be. Let me introduce you to the story this way, and then we're going to read it together.
Joshua fought the battle of Jericho, 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 and
harm to you, Joe.
I'm alright.
But let me tell you, you can take your hip hop and your rap, but I mean, how good was that? Actually, look, my apologies if it was your congregation who produced this, but that's awful. That is awful. It's actually more of a struggle for me to figure out why we tell this story to children at all. So let's read it. This is a long read, but I think we need to get the impact of this story. Now, the gates of Jericho were securely barred because of the Israelites. No one went out and no one came in. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its king and its fighting men. March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have the whole army give a loud shout. Then the wall of the city will collapse and the army will go up, everyone straight in." So Joshua, son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, "Take up the ark of the covenant of the Lord and have 7 priests carry trumpets in front of it." And he ordered the army, "Advance, march around the city with an armed guard going ahead of the ark of the Lord." When Joshua had spoken to the people, the 7 priests carrying the 7 trumpets before the Lord went forward, blowing their trumpets, and the ark of the Lord's covenant followed them. The armed guard marched ahead of the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard followed the ark. Isn't it amazing how quickly these people managed to fuse the presence of God in the ark? The ark was this box that represented the presence of God. How quickly they fused religion with militarism. And in front and behind of the ark, the presence of God goes the army. As if God needed protection. But Joshua had commanded the army, "Do not give a war cry, do not raise your voices, do not say a word until the day I tell you to shout. Then shout." So he had the ark of the Lord carried around the city, circling it once. Then the army returned to camp and spent the night there. Joshua got up early the next morning, and the priests took the ark of the Lord. The 7 priests carrying the 7 trumpets went forward, marching before the ark of the Lord and blowing the trumpets. And the armed men went ahead of them, and the rear guard followed the ark of the Lord while the trumpets kept sounding. So on the 2nd day, they marched around the city once and returned to the camp, and they did this for 6 days. On the 7th day, they got up at daybreak, marched around the city 7 times in the same manner, except that on the day they circled the city 7 times. The 7th time around, when the priests sounded the trumpet blast, Joshua commanded the army, "Shout! For the Lord has given you the city. The city and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are..." If you don't know the story, you're wondering where the prostitute's thinking. That's a whole other story. That may be for another day. "But she's saved. But keep away from the devoted things so that you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise you will make the camp of Israel liable to destruction and bring trouble on it. All the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord and must go into his treasury." When the trumpet sounded, the army shouted, and at the sound of the trumpet, when the men gave a loud shout, the wall collapsed. So everyone charged straight in and they took the city. They devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed with the sword every living thing in it. Men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep, and donkeys. I didn't see that when the children were singing spiritual. J- Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, go into the prostitute's house and bring her out and all who belong to her in accordance with your oath to her. So the young men who had done the spying went in and brought out Rahab. Just to give a background to that, earlier they'd spied out the land and a bunch of men were selected from this tribe that had been wandering around in the desert, in the wilderness for all these years. They were selected to go across into the land that they were about to claim and to spy it out, just to do a little bit of advanced research on what it would take to take the land. I am utterly unsurprised that that 12 men, suddenly freed from the constraints of family and community, find themselves in a city for the first time, and they go into a prostitute's house, and they are welcomed there and kept safe. I have no doubt they also did what men do in those places. But in return for the hospitality they received, this woman was instructed, Rahab, who ran the brothel, was instructed to bring all her family into the house and they would be saved. They brought out Rahab, her father, mother, her brothers and sisters, and all who belonged to her. They brought out her entire family and put them in a place outside the camp of Israel. Then they burned the whole city and everything in it. But they put the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord's house. But Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her, because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho, and she lives among the Israelites to this day. At that time Joshua pronounced this solemn oath, cursed before the Lord is the one who undertakes to rebuild this city, Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn son, he will lay its foundations. At the cost of his youngest, he will set up its gates. What's the picture of God that emerges from that story for you? I'd be interested to hear your reactions to that. What's the God that emerges out of this story?
Greedy and bloodthirsty.
Pardon? Say that loud so we can...
Greedy and bloodthirsty.
Greedy and bloodthirsty. You know, isn't it extraordinary? The God who emerges in this story is a bit like any tyrant of the day. Mm-hmm. You know, kill your enemies, but don't you dare touch any of the valuables here, because they're mine. And if you take them, I will kill you and all your family. Yeah, bloodthirsty. Like, it is interesting, if you read before this chapter in the book of Joshua, there's no evidence that God said to Joshua, kill everything in the city. He does say, destroy their army. But there's no place where it says, God said, kill every living thing and burn it.
But there are instances God does that.
Yeah.
And in fact, like when Saul doesn't kill all of the animals in the town, Saul is punished for it.
Yeah.
Which is disturbing.
Very disturbing. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Whether, yeah, and what we've got to do as adults when we know the cost of this, we've got to figure out what do we do with this, what do we do with this story?
I forgot, there wasn't any previous, enmity with Jericho before, or was there? So Jericho hadn't done anything.
Jericho hasn't appeared in the story of the Bible to this point. This is, now, it is presented that that they had finished their wilderness wandering, and they are now about to cross over the river into the land of promise, and the first barrier they meet to a land of promise is a walled city.
It was just in the way.
It was in the way. And they had to negotiate somehow past the city if they were going to possess this promised land.
But the fact they were able to walk all the way around it seems to indicate they could have just gone by.
Yeah, everybody hear that? Yeah, there's no doubt about it. This is one of the founding stories of this new nation. One more thing. Yeah, we do it at this stage. No, we won't. We'll do it later. want to do an exercise with you now, which you can do with as many people as you like, or if you need a bit of space, you can do it by yourself. But paper and pens here. We've got to find our way in and underneath and behind this story. And what does it? How do we handle? How could we handle it as adults today? So you have this. You have this group of people, former slaves in Egypt, who have been released, who have been on a long journey to a land of promise. They encounter a river that they have to cross in order to enter this land of promise. And then when they get across the river, they find the most technologically advanced defensive city. The walls of Jericho, it's the thing that they notice most about Jericho. It's the size and scale of the walls. This is the most, in that day, one of the most sophisticated defenses that was known at the time. And the walls of Jericho are held up as a very much a protected and secure defensive community. And here come this caravan of wandering people coming out of wilderness, coming out of slavery and poverty and difficult living. And they are meeting this solid defensive wall, the most technologically advanced defenses then known. For the sake of our exercise this morning, to help us understand, to carry with us those words of Barbara Brown Taylor, to help us open another door in this story, I want to suggest for our considerations that we, and I mean us in this room, I mean this nation, I mean my own place back home, we are not the people coming out of the desert. I want to suggest, just for the sake of this exercise and for opening a new door on this story, that we are the people behind the wall. That we are residents of Jericho. What I would like you to do, and I give you just, this can only just be the beginning of this exercise. I want us to try and imagine our way into a person standing behind the wall, faced, like, this isn't an equal battle. You're standing behind the wall of the city, and this ragtag, you know, all right, there's a lot of them, but, you know, they're not anywhere near as wealthy, not anywhere near as sophisticated, not anywhere near as well armed as we are behind the wall.
Spears and trumpets.
Spears and trumpets in a box. And I've got walls. So, I want you to try and imagine your way into the story, into the life of somebody behind the wall. Be one of Rahab's family. You might want to be a soldier on the wall. You might want to be a shopkeeper. You might want to be the mayor of the town. And begin to consider the question, what do I have to fear? That sound like a task? If anybody needs paper, please, you know, take some here. We can pass it around. If you need two buried in at the back. If you want to take some space elsewhere in this building, it would go to the library for a bit of peace and quiet. Yeah. If you want to do it with a neighbor sitting beside you, please do. and then nothing you're doing in this is going to be, you're not going to have to be required to read any of this out, nor reveal anything that you've reflected on at all, but it's simply for this exercise so that we go to the second part. We haven't got much time. I'll give you, we'll be back here at 9:15. Quarter to 10, sorry. Does 9:45 make sense? So it's just over 10 minutes, and then we gather again, and we've got a couple of other things to begin to reflect on, and I'd be interested to hear some of your own reactions to that. So, again, as said before, act like you understand what I've asked you to do, and we'll meet again in a few minutes.
Yeah, I'm going to go to the next one.
founding myths need to be re-examined and maybe need to be retold or recast, or we need to find new ways of telling the story, new ways of describing the community or the nation or the family that is more nurturing and sustaining and more spacious. This is a fascinating founding myth. I'm not a historian of these things, but I believe that the archaeologists tell us that the city of Jericho was abandoned possibly several hundred years before these people came across the river. But the leaders of this nation coming across the river knew that they needed a story sufficient to sustain this community of people in this new land, particularly facing all the challenges they felt they would face. And so they come across these ruins as they come across the river, and they're ruins. And they construct a story that tells something about our God over against their God, because they know that this story is not for us today, because we're here. It's for several generations in the future. So, the question, though, in an effort to kind of recast something of a founding story, is to try and imagine this from the backside of this story, from the other angle of this story. And did anything strike you in your reflections or in your conversations about the issue of fear for the people inside the walls? Anybody want to contribute a comment or two? Yes.
Well, I am a mother inside the wall, and I feel like I'm...
Speak up. I should do
can
this.
Can I read what I... Well,
here, let me give you that.
Just hold it. I'm a mother inside the walls. We are safe, my children and I. We're protected by the wall. And who are these people anyway? Wanderers with no army to speak of. They do not know our ways. They cannot overcome us. Then why am I afraid? Their horns and their focused marching make me afraid. But I will guard myself and my children inside here in my house. The shouts, the walls fall. I will die anyway. Whether I'm protected or not, I am afraid.
Thank you. Anybody else want to bring in? Yes.
Well, just the one thing that we thought about was, why did they have a wall in the first place? Had they been invaded before? She brought that up, and I never really thought about that. They obviously had it because they felt they needed protection.
Yeah, isn't it a really interesting thing? And partly, this is a world in, you know, this world of the story is a world in which life is about conquer or be conquered. This is the way people have shaped the world they live in. And there is no other story other than both protect yourself and defend yourself. And when the founding myth of the story is what we have, we hold, that dictates a whole stance towards the world. And over time, that shapes who you are. Somebody reminded me this just during the conversation session. This was meant to be Moses in the burning bush today. My apologies if you came here expecting that. But you know, as I reflected on that, it occurred to me from the beginning when I was putting this together, this was the story I didn't want to do. This is the story that weighed heaviest on me, and I suspect, and this is the one I've been carrying, as I said, the heaviest, and I suspect psychologically I just want to get it out of the way. Because I think there's something here about a mindset that is defensive towards the rest of the world, that shapes us, and therefore, even within the walls, you're fearful. The most technologically, this was the best defensive system in the world at the time. This is the best way, was to build a wall. And you know the thing that scares me most about this story, talking about this story here in the United States, is that actually, I'll put this, what they find inside the walls of this city is that the walls are actually not particularly good as a defense in the first place. And it may be that people who, in this country, who are most in favor of the defensive mindset of the world and the threat that outsiders pose, it might be that they're right. That the outsider, that those who have come here and then hunkered down and built the walls, we need that because actually the defenses we put up against the wall are really, really fragile. Even if they're missiles and tanks and they fall at a shout. And it may be that the higher we build, back in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, we have, in the city of Belfast, we have over 25 miles of walls separating Protestant and Catholic communities. And you know the worst thing? Most of those walls have been built since the peace agreement was signed.
No.
Could you believe that?
No.
And because we haven't done away with the posture of fear towards the other. We have stopped, by and large, we have stopped the bombings and the shootings. But the posture of fear and defensiveness to the other is still there. And we recognize that the peace we enjoy is really, really fragile, so we build walls. And that just makes safety even harder and security even harder. And so it might be, for instance, in the case of what's happening on your southern border, it might be that people are right when they say these people who are coming to our border threaten our entire way of life. You know, it could be the dismantling of America as white America knows it.
Well, and I think it's what we're, you know, what are we protecting? You know, and we're building more fear by building the walls higher. And is that how we want to live our lives?
Right.
Live our lives in fear.
So,
or do we want to knock the walls down and
No. So my question is, what is there to fear?
Change
and loss. And part of the challenge of putting ourselves into this position, actually it doesn't take a great deal here, certainly, to put ourselves into that position, because that fear is the kind of fear we're living with. That what we have is very fragile and can fall at a shout. We're not facing an army equally armed. We're not facing an army equally, people equally resourced. We are facing people with nothing, and they do threaten everything. The question is, what's on the other side? What possibilities are open on the other side? And what do we have to do now to embrace the kind of change that might, can we risk the possibility that it might be change in a positive direction? That it might be that embracing this change, whether it's in the conflict of race here, whether it's in the conflict with immigrant communities, or language, whatever it is, can we risk the fact that this change is actually, we are being sprung from the prisons we are creating for ourselves? Because what are the encircling walls of Jericho? They are at one and the same time, they are a defense, but they are also a prison. And could it be possible that we don't have to wait for the destructive shout to cause the walls to collapse and to cause death? Could it be, could we possibly even imagine the risk of a dismantling of the walls between me and the other? Could the dismantling of those walls of difference between us and the creating of a unity between us in love, which is our theme for the summer, could that be the means to spring us from the prison?
I think it's so hard to, I mean, one of the problems we have in our nation is we know who we are and how our nation was founded, because here we came in and as conquerors, then why wouldn't we assume that the next, you know, people outside the wall or outside wherever are going to be conquerors just like we are. Like, that's been the very root of who we are today.
Yep.
And we've never repented for it. Very minimally.
Yep.
Right? So, of course, that's what's in the deepest essence of our being.
Yep.
Seeing a threat where...
Yeah.
How the white population got possession of the land here continues to shape your posture towards, because you know the cost to you, because that's what you feel, to get and hold the land, and you're worried that others who want it from you are going to do the same to you as you did to the people who were here before. Mm-hmm. You know, there's another connection between Northern Ireland. This is, and again, I'm not a historian. I couldn't back it up, but many of the people, Northern Ireland, the northeastern corner of the island of Ireland, was the most resistant to British rule. And they finally lost patience with that northeastern corner, and they gave land to Anglicans, and they invited Presbyterians from Scotland to come over and take the land. And they took it from the indigenous Catholic population, forcing them off the good land and forcing them up into the hills. And so you can still see them in around Northern Ireland today, these defensive farms that were built defensively because they were absolutely right. Their enemies were above them, looking down on them in the hills and the mountains around, looking down on them. So they built mini forts for their farms. Anyway, there's a whole long story, it happens, but 150 years later, the Presbyterians that came over decided they've had enough of this, and they sailed from Northern Ireland, many of them, and settled down along the east coast of this country. In fact, there's a festival every year in the next village along from the town I live in, called the Eagle Wing Festival, and it celebrates a whole Presbyterian community that boarded a boat in this village and sailed over here. Do you know what? They sailed over here and they carried with them the lessons they learned from their ancestors' settlement of Ulster 150 years later. And forgive me for saying it, but I'm going to be really blunt with it, part of that lesson was the mistake we made in Ulster was letting the indigenous population live. And we won't make that mistake when we go to the new land of promise. The way to secure ownership is to conquer.
Destroy,
to tear down. And then, the problem is then, you get shaped in this mindset of conquest. And you see everybody. What's that saying? To the man who has a hammer, every problem's a nail. So you come here, we've claimed it through conquest and violence, and we imagine everybody wants it and wants to take it in the same way. And then along comes, in our tradition, along comes a reinterpretation of these stories. If we had time, what I would love to do is to spend an equal amount of time saying, how do we read this story through the lens of what we know about Jesus. Because Jesus, you know, Joshua's saying, God says, kill them all. Then Jesus comes along and says, if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. Can we conceive of any way in which Jesus would have given the instruction to tear this city down and kill all these people? Yes, sir.
So Isaiah 55 says, your ways are not my ways are not your ways. And that's a verse talking about compassion. I believe that the same as God parted the Red Sea, and he knocked Jericho's walls down, and he calmed the sea when Christ said, be calm, and he parted the river so that they were stopped, backed up the river so that they could walk across, the same people that he parted the river, or parted the sea for, he knocked the walls down. It's really hard for us as Christians looking in Christ's eyes, Christ trying to look at his, why would he kill off all of these people? So my ways are not your ways. You don't understand. Throughout the Bible, there's numerous cases where basically you're not going to understand my ways. So one way that I was able to help my head and heart get around killing off these people is God knows prophetically, looking in the future, what's going to happen. He knows what the next enemy of Israel is. He knows that if he lets these people walk around, it's a great point, they could have walked around, but he also knows what's coming. And maybe that's their next enemy that's going to be attacking Israel wherever they land. Now, the hard thing to get your head around is women and children, or children, youth, young, etc., babies. But the other side of that is if we look at our trust in God, our Savior, that will give us life eternally with him, he can choose to take whoever he wishes with him. Now, the only thing in Scripture that really addresses that is specifically when Christ says, bring the children unto me.
Yeah.
And you know, that's how I've got my head around that, is he can choose whoever he wipes out as a nation. He knows who the enemy is, and he knows who the little infants who are innocent, he can take them with him.
But I don't doubt for a moment that Joshua, leaving aside the fact that there is no evidence whatsoever of a settlement in that part of the world at the time we know they crossed the river, leave that aside, could we possibly entertain, well, how I make sense of it is that I believe absolutely that Joshua was convinced that the way to take this land was through conquest and genocide. Because Joshua was a product of his time, and that's how people did it. But we also see evidence in the text of the Bible itself wrestling with precisely, you know, they had consciences as well, and they wrestled with the conscience and constantly. That understanding of God is being chipped away at through the course of the text, and they begin to find space for strangers in a way that they never did at the beginning. And the fullest revelation of the heart of God for the world is in Jesus. It's not that God has changed and changed his mind about how to do things. It's the fact that as we seek to live faithfully within this story and walk our way through this wilderness journey, we grow in our understanding of who God is. And we see in the text of the Bible, we see people wrestling with precisely that question. What does it mean to live today in relationship with God? And for us, I don't think there is any excuse for us on issues. I don't think there's any justification for what happened in the conquest of this land as it's told here. When we look back through the lens that Jesus offers us. As the fullest revelation of God, I don't think it's possible to find a justification for what happened, except to say that is how they understood it and how they were shaped by the culture they lived in. We now live on the other side of the revelation of God in Jesus, and we need to try and figure this out. But the one thing we know is we're called to love the stranger, love the other. We're called to love the neighbor as ourselves. And forgive me if violence has no part in it. The cross is the final revelation of what happens if we don't deal with the other in our midst. It is the revelation of the violence that we are capable of in the face of difference. And we've an opportunity, we are given an opportunity. There is no redemption in the story of Jericho. The redemption in the story of Jericho lies outside the story, and it's in our hands, in the light of the life of Jesus. We are not meant to endorse that as a means of conquest or a means of holding on to land. It is given to us and say, in the light of the life of Jesus, and says, and we're told, do better. Do better than this. That's where the revelation of this, the redemption in this story rests. The opportunity given to us to do better this time in the light of the example of Jesus. Now, I recognize this is a complicated story, we're way past time. I'm not going to rush away, and we can take this conversation elsewhere. I give a commitment not to leave the room, in the sense of sometimes the Bible and the reading of the text is meant to comfort us. Sometimes it needs to discomfort us. And not all conflict is bad. And I give you a commitment that if this has pushed buttons for you and you feel strongly that you want to wrestle with some of these further, I give you a commitment that I'm not going to walk out of the room, and I will stay in that conversation. Because we've got to find ways of talking about these things that doesn't push us to the margins and away from one another, so that we end up shouting and demonizing the other side of the room. We need to find ways of talking about these difficult things. And sometimes we can put the Bible text into the middle of the room and begin our conversation through the Bible text, and then take it into the issues that really matter for us. Thank you for staying in the room.